Welcome to this Standard Forum and LSE Ideas event. Thank you all for coming. And we've got an action-packed program, so I'm going to keep the introduction fairly brief, merely to say that this is a wonderful occasion to launch a special report that has been produced by colleagues here at the LSE and others who've very kindly joined us here for this evening to launch the event. My name, I should say, Robert Faulkner. I'm the co-director of the Dahnler Forum. But it is really Olivia Gibner who has pulled this report together. She's done a sterling job. It's the second of our special reports that the Dahnler Forum has produced on Europe's relations with the world. This one, as you know, focuses on Asia, and we're very pleased to be able to launch it tonight. There will be two more events, one in Berlin, one in Brussels, so do join us again in case you happen to be in those places. We've got a wonderful panel here. They've all contributed to the report, and they've all kindly agreed to debate their contributions. We're going to go into brief statements one by one by the contributors, and then I will give you all the chance to come in for general questions and answers. So hopefully by about, we've got about 5 to 10 minutes each, so halfway through the session I will then open the floor for discussion. And I will make sure that our colleagues here are on time. Let me introduce them one by one. I will do this at the beginning, and then I will simply give you the floor later on. Let me start at the far end to my left. Olivia Gibner, who, as you know, has pulled this together. She's very masterly edited the report. She's a postdoctoral fellow, Dahndorf postdoctoral fellow here at the LSE, at LSE Ideas. She's attached to the Dahndorf Working Group on the EU and China and Asia. The group exists at the Hertie School in Berlin, but Olivia is our bridgehead of that group here at the LSE, and she's been conducting research on European-Asian relations and is now focusing with this report on the strategic dimension. I have then a bit further to the right, but still to my left, Dr. Thomas Hennecke, who is a senior researcher at the German Development Institute in Bonn, where he works on researches and advises on external relations, focusing including also on Asia. He's a specialist on comparative politics and organization theory, and we're very pleased that you've made the fairly short trip to here, but hopefully the trip wasn't too difficult. I don't think at the moment this is the case. I then have Dr. Michael Reiterer to the right of Thomas, who's an adjunct professor for international politics at the University of Innsbruck, and he's also an advisor to the External Action Service in Brussels on the Asian region more generally, and he contributes this paper that he's written in personal capacity, so I think it's well worth noting that, and I presume your remarks will be in personal capacity as well. We then have Robert Cooper, who's a visiting professor here at LSE Ideas and the senior fellow in the Dahndorf Forum. Robert is usually introduced as a retired diplomat, but I'm not going to do that because he still very much engages in certain forms of diplomacy, working actively for the OSCE and still traveling around the world on various missions. So I think semi-retired is perhaps the more appropriate description. But of course, Robert is very much engaged here at LSE Ideas in the Dahndorf Forum, bringing in his practical experience into this, and again, he's written in this report. And last but not least, Jerry Yu, to my left, who is also based here at the LSE Ideas think tank. She's a member of the Dahndorf Forum team. She's a specialist on Chinese foreign policy, decision-making in Chinese foreign policy. I think it's fair to say that nobody understands and knows the machinery in China as well as Jerry does. She also runs a high-level strategic dialogue for LSE Ideas involving Chinese experts and China experts in the West. And again, we're very pleased that you were able to come talk to us today. So I think the running order is that Olivia will first speak about the report, and then we will hand over to the panel in roughly this order. Is this the idea?
Almost, yeah.
Okay. Robert will go last. Okay. I'm sure we'll work it out. All right. Good. Olivia.
Thank you for the introduction.
So the European Union's relationship with Asia-Pacific has changed. From what used to be focused on development cooperation and assistance, we now talk about cooperation and even competition. So the report, Changing Waters Towards a New EU-Asia Strategy, explores an overhaul of this relationship. And I think this is more important than ever in the context of the rising Asian powers and the US pivot to Asia. At the same time, the EU has been struggling with several internal crises, the euro crisis, the refugee situation, and the danger of kind of disintegration that we're facing now. But as Jawaharlal Nehru said, crises and deadlocks, when they occur, have at least this advantage, that they force us to think. So I'm delighted to be here today and to launch this report together with you. And to begin with, I would like to quickly thank, first of all, our chair and the co-director of the Dahrendorf, Dr. Robert Faulkner, who encouraged me to go forward with this idea. Our panelists here today, Sir Robert Cooper, Michael Reiterer, Thomas Hennickel, and Yujie, and the 13 contributors who contributed to the report. Then the LSE Ideas editorial team with Alex and Joseph and Indira, and the Dahrendorf Forum, of course, in particular Louise, Sasha, and Ingrid for their support. Allow me a few remarks on the origins of this report. The idea and the concept were motivated by three broad reasons. First, my own research on Asian perceptions of the EU for the past 5 years. The EU looks quite different from Beijing, Yangon, or Canberra than when we Europeans think about it. It is sometimes considered an imperialist power, and with double standards when it's seen forcing countries to adapt or to European preferences, or when the EU seems to compromise Nepalese sovereignty when reconnecting with its much bigger neighbor India. Secondly, there's a global strategic review under the High Representative Federica Mogherini going on at the moment, and after much consultation, a new kind of relaunched strategy will be published in June. And finally, the question of whether reducing European weight also means that we should rethink our relationship with Asia. So the need for a clear EU strategy is identified, but to develop a strategy, we need several ingredients. First of all, what are the European Union's specific interests? And what has kept the EU from developing a more coherent strategy until now? The answer, again, is a mix of factors, both internal and external. The lack of priority given to the region as opposed to other regions. Just think of the EU-Turkey deal, how quickly it came about when we compare it to free trade negotiations with India, for example. Also, Asia-Pacific is highly diverse. EU member states are sometimes in competition with each other, and when they woo access to certain countries like China. So a too coherent European strategy is maybe not even in their interest. And then the EU's internal divisions. The EU-Asia relationship is the most powerful on its economic and trade issues. And yet, the EU's trade department and its international arm do not necessarily share the same vision. So with this limitation in mind, the report puts forward suggestions for concrete areas of functional cooperation. Particularly important across all countries are the areas where the EU has something unique to offer. This is the case on climate change policy, where it pioneered emissions trading, but also less sexy, but also more important elements like car emission standards or chemicals regulations. Other promising areas for cooperation are in the field of disaster management or anti-terrorism, where the EU and Asia-Pacific are struggling to deal with the same challenges. Prioritizing collaboration on these issues and creating truly pan-European, pan-Asian networks would also better reflect this new relationship at an eye level. So we are fortunate because the EU has embarked on this effort, to the soul-searching exercise, and we hope that this report will provide an input to this process. And each contributor is an expert in the field they're writing about, and they answered or tried to answer the question, how can we change the EU strategy towards Asia-Pacific to reflect the new global order better, and at the same time serve European and global interests? So in today's panel, we are lucky to reflect on these questions from various perspectives. Michael will provide us with his first-hand assessment of the Asia-Pacific's security arrangements. Jerry will mirror the EU's strategic ambition and maybe remind us of the remaining conceptual gaps between the two. Thomas will give us his perspective on a changing development cooperation, as many Asian countries are graduating from recipients to aid donors. And finally, I'm particularly looking forward to Robert Cooper's more personal account of the EU's role in Myanmar. He himself has been an indispensable representative during the transition. And if I understand well, he went back to Yangon in February. And I'm curious to hear what your assessment of the longevity of European influence could be. So allow me to conclude with a question. I think I'm not overstating that Europe and the European Union are standing at a new juncture in global politics. In this environment of power shift, should we follow the Chinese reformer Deng Xiaoping's advice and cross the river by feeling the stones? Or should the EU rather develop a strong compass to navigate through these changing waters? Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Olivia. So we hand over to Michael. And would you like to stay here or come to the podium? All right.
Well, thank you very much. I cannot say here I'm standing because otherwise I fall asleep. That's normally what you say when you are traveling to jet-lagged, but this is not the case. But it's always nice to get out of Brussels these days because with all the military men in front of my office, it's not so nice to be there, I must say. But let me get into the changing waters, and I will conclude my remarks with waters. And the water I have in mind will be the South China Sea, but I will come to it. First, a few thoughts about the strategy, or the more strategic approach. I'm now nearly 35 years in that business, so I'm not competing with Robert, but I have done 17 years in the Austrian service, 17 years in the European service. So sometimes I'm wondering what I am and what we do. So it's an interesting comparison. But I think what we have to do is what I described in the beginning of my paper a little bit. We have to move from ad hoc to more strategic planning. And we have to move from words, where we are very good, and especially adjectives, we are masters of adjectives. We have to move now to deeds. And I think we should also move from putting out fires to securing the environment in which we want to work. And that we have to do in a sort of comprehensive security. When I came back after my ambassadorship to Switzerland and I started to work again on Asia, I introduced with member states a discussion on the EU's security interests in Asia. And that took me 9 months just to convince my own people that this is a worthwhile exercise. And that's sometimes that what we are, our problem. A lot of energy I need to convince my colleagues in-house before I can, I will not say face the enemy, but work with the other partners, with member states first, and then talk to the rest of the world with our Asian partners. So, but I think that was then facilitated, of course, with the changes which we have in the setup of the European External Action Service, where we should become a little bit more political compared to what we have done in the context of the Commission. I'm still one of the co-authors of the 2001 Asia Strategy, which was done at the time by the Commission, which I would not call today anymore a strategy. I think what we have done very well, we have collected everything which was there and have said, well, that's what it is. But I think if you have to have a strategy, then you have to figure out why are you doing something, how are you doing it, which means, which priority, and how do you implement it. I think that makes a strategy. Otherwise, you have a policy paper, but you have to translate it into action. Where we are challenged now, and I think this is not easy, and that's part of the perception game, when I go to Asia, we are still our perception is still very much an economic animal, a qualified import-export club. So if you come now that we have a political interest, a strategic interest, and a security interest, then you have to convince people first. And that also means we have to change a little bit the narrative, because the narrative is changing. And instead of this traditional economic and market-driven narrative, we have to change also to a security narrative within the institution and transport it. And there we need also a better mix, because we were very good always to be on the moral high ground, what we should do, what our principle and value-based foreign policy should be all about. But we have to add to that, I think, a clearer definition, what are the European interests and what are the red lines? What are we willing to compromise, but what are we willing and decided to implement? I think if we don't manage to get this profile, then we will not be respected. And I think this is one of the major issues we have to work on, an interest-based policy, and to give us the means to actually implement it. And if I mean implementation, I mean action and not just declarations. Now, let me turn now quickly to Asia-Specific. The EU will not be and is not a game changer in Asia. That's very clear. But I think we have to play a role there. And we will only have credibility if we set ourselves goals which we can actually realize and where we have the means and the political will to implement it. And I think therefore this exercise is welcome. And we have to think also a little bit out the box. I am personally convinced that we also have to add the military-to-military dimension. If I want to have a serious security dialogue with our Chinese colleagues, I am assured that I have some people in uniform who talk to the PLA, because these PLA people, they will happily have a drink with me, but they don't regard me as a serious partner. They want to have somebody in uniform, and we should give them somebody in uniform. And we should also have perhaps some security advisors, which is a military attaché, something like that, I think, to make the point. But I'm not just in favor of the military element. I'm deeply convinced, and I have published quite a bit, we also need a cultural diplomacy. I have prepared it 3 or 4 years ago and was shot down by the management at the time because that was a negative priority. Last week, High Representative Mogherini gave a speech on a cultural diplomacy. So you see, you just have to wait a few years and then finally you get it. But you can already read my article, which was published 2 years ago. It was already there, and I can prove it. We also have to see how do we get along with geopolitics and geoeconomics. I think this is becoming an interesting mixture. I think we will hear something about OBOR, One Belt, One Road. What is it? Is it an investment diplomacy of China? Is it an extension of domestic politics, or is it geopolitics? We have to see. And what the Chinese are very good at, they ask us, figure out what it is, and 4 or 5 years ago we were desperately trying to figure out what the Chinese dream is all about. Now we were working on that one, and now we have another issue to work. We also have to see, and I think this is a change, European Union used to have a little bit the approach, we are an integration mechanism, so the rest of the world has to integrate too. However, if you look in Asia, it's intergovernmental, it's pragmatic, it's not legal, and it's functional. So we can work very well with ASEAN, yes, that's what we do, what we should do, but however, the world, the Asian world, will not change according to our ideas. We better have to adapt to their idea, and the appetite to go for a deep integration is simply not there. And I think we have to do it. We have to work accordingly. Also, I always like to say it is a little bit strange in ASEAN that we are the largest contributor to the ASEAN Secretariat. Isn't that strange? So our ASEAN friends, they have the system that everybody pays the same amount of money. So Laos pays as much as Singapore. Well, you will talk about development ideas. Is that a good development idea? Because what is the reaction is others make a trust fund, and if you have a trust fund, you can control the money. Now, to cut it short, what I argue also in the paper is less is more. So I think if we want to be a credible player in Asia, then we should concentrate on a few issues and really to them. So I would see in the security field, I would say we should work with our Asian partners for strengthening and participating in a regional security architecture. I think this is something where we have can play a role. We should uphold the rule of law, and that's where the South China Sea issue comes in. We have issued about 10 days ago a declaration on that issue, and we are watching what is going on between the Philippines and China in The Hague. And I think this is what this rule all about. It's about the procedure. We are not taking a position on the sovereignty issue, however, on the procedure. And if you have signed up to the UNCLOS, United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, there we have the interesting situation. China has ratified and doesn't want to implement it. The United States has not ratified it and wants to implement it. That's a little bit the paradox which we have there. But what does UNCLOS mean? That land dominates the sea. And therefore, it is difficult to argue that you can claim the nine dashed lines, which is about 2,000 nautical miles away from any land. Therefore, it will be interesting what we will see from the South China Sea Tribunal. It will not be about sovereignty. It will not be about delimitation. It will all be about definition. But if the definition is that a rock is a rock and not an island, then the whole concept of the nine dashed line can collapse. And that's interesting, and therefore the Chinese are so interested in that case and try to tell us every 5 minutes, don't say anything about it. This is not your business. But again, I think we have a stake. We have a stake because we have signed up to the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation. We have the same status there as China, and that gives me the right to talk about the South China Sea, because that's what the treaty is all about. And I must say, we have repeated that now for 2 years, and 2 weeks ago when I was in Beijing, for the first time I heard from the Chinese, okay, we understand that the European Union is interested in the area. So that took us quite some time, and as they are lobbying that we shouldn't say something, obviously they see a role for us. And others are lobbying that we are saying something. So I think this rule of law element is an important element. Sorry, I'm already getting into your speech and pushing some buttons, so I better shut up here. The main issue, main message is credibility, profile, and don't give the impression that you can fix each and every problem under the sun. That we cannot do, and therefore less is more, and I think if we implement that, we will really do more.
Thank you very much, Michael. All right, good. We'll move straight on. Thomas, would you like to come
up? Yeah,
on?
For sure.
Right. So we are already in the middle of this. So I'd like to start by thanking the organizers, and especially, of course, Olivia, for this occasion to be here and to have been able to contribute to this, I think, very coherent and very meaningful collection of very interesting contributions. So that's a piece of work that is very much appreciated, I think. My contribution to this report and the subject of my brief talk here is development policy, the European Union's development policy in Asia. I tend to think that, as Michael said, I mean, we have to be realistic about the impact we can make. Also in the field of development policy, that's why I chose the title, Is There a Place for Europe in Asia and for European Development Policy at All? And I'd like to start by talking about Europe's eastern promises or eastern ambitions, if you want, what are we looking at? Well, Europe wants to be a force of constructive engagement in the world. We do this, as Olivia said in the beginning, in the middle of a turbulent international environment and in the middle of an internal crisis that some would say is existential. There is, as always, a risk of being too reactive, too hesitant, to be driven purely by the contingencies, by the events that surround us, and that we are somehow bypassed by new realities that arise. Now, what we saw, or what we are witnessing now with a new development paradigm looming at the horizon, is we are phasing out aid in many countries, as already said. Countries, we say, are graduating because they are now classified as middle-income countries, not taking into account the inequalities within countries. And does this amount to Europe simply fading away in many of these countries? Or what are we going to replace this cooperation with? So there's a big uncertainty among the partner countries as well as in the development community all around what shape this future cooperation may take. Now, just a brief word, this is an awful slide, I know, but just so to give you the background, what are the present challenges for EU development policy? Well, first and foremost, I think it should be shaping agendas in the discussions about global government structures and to somehow help creating favorable conditions for international institutions and regimes that are inherently developmental, if I can say that. And then we have to really get our house in order and make sure that we achieve policy coherence in view of a sustainable development agenda, and to streamline our a number of foreign policy goals, but also internal policies with the development issues and agendas. So I just put a number of them here. Useless to say, you can very easily understand that all of these security, trade, financial flows, financial integrity, energy, climate change, extractive industries, all of them have a role to play in development, of course. And as we see, at least in the report, they are of central importance in Asia. So what are the questions I try to address in this short piece? It is, how do we in Europe go about to achieve our goals and somehow to not let go completely our ambitions in the field of development? We also have to think about who are our most I say most suitable, that doesn't mean that they are unsuitable partners, but who are the most strategic partners to work with in view of those aims? And are we ourselves, is the European Union fit for purpose? Do we have the right instruments, as Michael said? And which are the reform gaps or reform needs that need to be addressed? What are the risks in this process? And what is our desirable and the expected, realistically expected impact? I think a question the EU has to ask and answer in the next few years is the institutional mainframe, let's say, the way the institutions in Brussels work, is it really can it really have this impact that we would like to see? And does it make foreign policy more effective? I just put this slide here as a mean of illustration. Michael said it. The time that we take to coordinate internally here among all these actors and stakeholders that are only inside the Brussels machinery is precious. And that, in many instances, it leads to the fact that by the time we come up with a decision, I think nobody cares anymore what we decided about, so, or people have forgotten. Yeah.
Or delusion completely.
Yeah, delusion. Yeah. So, I mean, rightly, people make fun of us, but okay, we have a complex multi-level governance and administrative system. That's a fact. That's also part of the question of legitimacy and accountability and a lot of interest and stakeholders involved and so on and so forth, but we cannot stop here and say, well, that's how it is. So I think this is something that is still outstanding. There was supposed to be a reform going on of the European External Action Service, we haven't seen any progress since this paper in 2013 or 14. Be it as it may, I think we also have to get our act together and look outside the European Union. We face new realities. I was talking about a paradigm shift. Development paradigm is changing. There are new actors, notably China, as a game changer in the Asian region. We see a rapidly transforming international, not only development, but also economic system, changing forms and ways and combinations of international cooperation, South-South cooperation, triangular cooperation. There is a lot of literature on that. The European view is that development moves in a phase where we go beyond aid and we look for new partnerships. And we have to deal with a series of interconnected agendas, as you easily understand. The Sustainable Development Goals are intricately linked to climate, security, trade, development. We talk about these nexuses that make the work, I would say, challenging and complex to foresee the potential impact, positive and negative, of a certain policy measure in a field a priori, before the action. So what are the key priorities for European development policy? I think we need to reconceptualize our view on policy, on development policy, in a way that we go into sectoral policy coordination, cross-departmental, and adopt whole-of-government approaches at the different governance levels, at the European as well as at the member state level. We should invest in interregional orchestrations with our partners to somehow have more leverage in international institution building and in the reform of global governance structures, as mentioned, finance, trade, maritime governance, and so on and so forth. We need to improve our receptivity, but also our capacity of knowledge, skill, and technology transfer in a two-way manner with Asia as an importer and as an exporter of skill and knowledge, to be an enabler of growth, to enhance interconnectivity within societies, between business and other communities. We talk a lot about blending of instruments nowadays. This is a new form for many traditional development actors and thinkers. But I'm convinced that there is a lot of things to gain from this. And we have to look in the non-traditional security issues, which have a direct impact on development, disaster preparedness, conflict management, mediation, and so on and so forth. Further, I would think that Europe should deliberately make a choice to engage with regional institutions, right through. And this is also the case for multilateral banks. Europe was not joining, not making any bids for the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. I think that's a mistake. We need to invest in joint efforts for the provision of global public goods, human security, food security, biodiversity, and so on and so forth. We need to engage in multidimensional policy dialogues which do justice to the connectedness of subjects on technology, health, education, climate, and agriculture, and so on and so forth. And we need to be more apt and more... we need more Fingerspitzengefühl in the differentiation. We need to adapt our measures to the different countries in specific ways that we can actually achieve meaningful outcomes. and we need to ensure resilience and ownership. So we have a regional buy-in and we create durable structures, lasting institutions. And to have this multi-level societal and sectoral involvement in this process. I think there's a lot of learning to do here, and there's a lot to be gained. I think we may look at business development models and find fertile approaches there. Now, the bottom line for me would be the EU should stop the navel gazing and talking about its own internal crisis. That's, I guess, we have been through this up and down, so I think we stopped that here, and look for for more deeply rooted cooperation patterns. I think we should reach out and socialize. That's maybe a catchy, too catchy a phrase, but in basically it is. I think we should engage with partners to address real problems instead of doing our internal kitchen over and over again. So we need to develop a larger vision. I think, for example, to make a bold leap, we would need to push this comprehensive EU-ASEAN free trade, and I say a free and fair trade agreement that has been on ice since 2008, I guess. Nothing happened. It's partly also the problem of our Asian partners, which should be this umbrella agreement for all the bilateral agreements. We should give full market access to least developed countries, invest in capacity building to meet for them to meet the all the different standards we have, so they can really benefit from market access. We could do a lot to harmonize regulation and set global precedents for global governance structures. So I think we should meet the Asian partners at the eye level and allow jointly to learn with sort of ideas traveling back and forth and being and benefiting from this two testing laboratories we have in two different regions. So I think we need shared experience to develop common understanding, basically. So my vision would be we should become somehow each other's significant others in global governance. So that's...
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Fantastic. All right, I'll hand straight over to Cherry for a different take on this strategic part.
Well, I wouldn't say something different, but I would rather say it's more Dickensian take in here. Anyway, thank you so much for Robert's kind introduction and Olivia's really hard work to putting this excellent report together. And I'm extremely happy to be part of it. And part of the ethos for Dahrendorf 3 cycle in here, I have to make it clear, is try to understand Europe from the other angle. So how the other people outside Europe view the European Union as a foreign policy actor. So I'm very glad in here today to give some kind of like Chinese perspectives regarding the current state of the China-EU relations. So in the past 40 years, China and the EU has somehow engaged one of the most highly institutionalized partnerships compared with any other pairs of great power relations. And not just the trade negotiations they have been going through, but also alongside together they have 93 different policy area dialogues going on every year. So imagine how institutionalized that partnership it is. But however, this partnership is not really short of problems or challenges as such. Unless, unlike the China-US relations, which very much entangled with the geopolitics, whereas the China-EU relations seems to didn't really have any geopolitical entanglement at all. But what I'm saying here, there are at least three insurmountable challenges we'll be facing nowadays for the China-EU relation. And the firstly is essentially about there's a different views in terms of how we should organize international politics. So the Chinese very much believe the way how we organize the international relations should be based on power, on sovereignty, and on absolute control for the society. Whereas regarding the European Union, how we should organize in the international politics, as Michael said, it should be very much rule-based, and everything has to be done by principles and norms and values. And so this is one key difference. And the second key difference, which I would like to remind your European colleagues in here, somehow, they didn't quite understand the role of the Chinese Communist Party in here. So China is in this kind of very much unique and somehow even weird party-state system. So everything is not really led by the state, but led by the party. So party play an enormous role by both making domestic politics as well as a foreign policy. So somehow our European colleagues in here didn't quite get it. So that's another challenge for the EU. So the very last one is actually our own fault, or the Chinese own fault, by producing an enormously, incredibly complex bureaucratic system of making foreign policy. So no one in Beijing, I mean, I guess all these foreign diplomats in Beijing, no one really quite understand who's in charge. So China has no answer for that famous quote by Kissinger on the European policy. You know, when I come to Europe, which number should I dial, which number should I call? Whereas in China nowadays, we're facing exactly the same dilemma. Like, when, for example, Michael in Beijing, who would you like to speak to? Would you like to speak to the state councillor, or would you like to speak to the foreign minister? So this is no answer as such. So these are the three insurmountable challenges we're facing here today. Regarding the first challenge, which I'm talking about different differences regarding rules and values, if you think about the South China Sea issue in here, is the whole differences on the multilateralism between China and the EU. For the EU, multilateralism should be a method to resolve all sort of transnational problems as well as hard security international conflicts. Whereas for China, this is multilateralism not as a multilateral but multipoles. The Chinese see the world consisting on different poles under the US hegemony. So below the US hegemony and China, what they're trying to do is try to forging partnerships together with various Europeans as well as Latin Americans or Africans to creating a sense of poles, try to somehow undermine the US supremacy and in terms of global affairs. So this is how the gap in here has been laid out. And of course, when you come back to the South China Sea issues, and China was very much hoping South China Sea issue is an Asian matter. It has to be decided within Asians, whereas the Europeans see, because the Chinese have very much breached the international maritime law. Therefore, European Union has to say something to regulate the Chinese behavior. So that I see that's where the mental gaps in here. And that's one key difference. The second one, which I'm going to talk about, is the party. And I know there are many questions regarding what kind of roles that the Chinese Communist Party play in here. And what I'd like to bring up is the Chinese Communist Party nowadays is really not a party guiding by ideology. So the days of Mao's ideas or Deng Xiaoping's ideas is over. And if you're asking the people on the street, what do we understand by Xi Jinping's ideas on China Dream? Nobody will tell you exactly what answer it is. But what we all want is to have a very good sense of economic well-being provided by the party. This is somehow is try to testing the party's governing capacity and how much economic well-being they can provide to the ordinary people. And that's the way, the only way the party can claim legitimacy. It's not really leading by the ideology, what ideology we believe. I mean, in China nowadays, we seem somehow become like a faceless society. Nobody really believes ideology anymore. So this is another thing perhaps Europeans should be aware. And you may disagree with me, but somehow this is what we Chinese think. Regarding on this party, another thing is seems somehow the Europeans have developing this habit of try to induce a domestic political reform inside China. The problem is the problem nowadays is that in China nowadays people don't really want to change the system. I mean, if you're asking people on the street, do they want to change the system? No one will give you a really precise answer because they don't know what is the alternative. As we can see in the past, or we can draw the example from Arab Spring, an unprepared and brutal political transition is a recipe for disaster. It's not a recipe for success. So as brutal as it can be, so for the Europeans' good economic well-being, to have a benevolent China, a economic stable and politically stable China is much easier to dealing with than compared with somehow a democratic regime somehow maybe leading towards a turbulence. So this is a second key difference in here. The third one, which I'd like to mention in here, is the fault very much lies within the Chinese foreign policy decision-making system. Over the past few years, the Chinese EU policy agenda has been expanded enormously, from simply political bilateral relations extended into international financial governance, climate change, and all various sort of areas. So by having all these specific issues China and the EU has to dealing with, and you require more professionalisms and expertise, foreign policy or foreign ministry alone or Ministry of Commerce alone cannot dealing with such complex issues. So foreign policy actors or certain actors such as People's Bank of China dealing with the exchange rate issues, or NDRC, National Reformation Commission, dealing with the climate change and energy problems. And these are not actors who are actually within the system of foreign policy making. These actors somehow become a foreign policy actor by default. So this is causing more confusion, because you have more cooks in the soup. And so obviously the flavor will be different. And Michael just mentioned on this very funny One Belt, One Road initiative. What analogy I like to draw in here is the One Belt, One Road, if you imagine the old story of you have three blind people want to try to catch elephant, and none of those people have seen the elephant. The first person have touched the trunk, thinking, okay, that's a trunk. And the second person assuming, oh, that's a column because it touched the leg of the elephant. And the third person touched the tails, which believe, okay, that's actually a snake. So somehow this One Belt, One Road initiative, we try to understand is we don't know exactly what it is. And then adding extra layers of that is you have the bureaucratic complexities. Who is directing this One Belt, One Road system or initiative? I mean, as I give the example previously, in LSE Ideas, we're constantly hosting high-level Chinese delegation. And every time we have a different departments or Chinese delegation coming here, they tell me 15 different answers. Who is actually the person in charge in Beijing for the One Belt, One Road system initiative? So this will put in the European partners very much unreservedly, doesn't really want to commit anything on this grand strategy. Is how should we really judging the criteria on which project should be put into this One Belt, One Road initiative, and who are providing the ultimate guarantor as the underwriter for this project if anything didn't go well? And this is something Chinese has to be answered. So, as I said, this is actually a fault lie within the system. So, if I may conclude in a very much a Dickensian fashion, the China-EU relations in the past 40 years is somehow a kind of great expectations yet wait to be unfulfilled. And a part of the reason is because the Europeans somehow lack of understanding towards China, because China is just far too complex. But on the other hand, it's also the Chinese decision makers somehow have to be aware by simply shopping around the world, buying infrastructure projects, this will not really give you any respect to your European partners. The best way to do is, this is actually something require more skilled diplomatic efforts, require more policy clarities, require more bureaucratic transparencies. This is something Chinese has to learn. But as I said, as a country which will only emerge from the world stage, from the periphery to the center in the past 30 years, and it's still so much we have to be learned, and it's still so much we have to be understanding the world. So that's my conclusion here. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, and last but not least, Robert Cooper, please.
Now, last but probably shortest, everyone else has been talking about European strategy towards Asia. What I wrote is really not—it's not strategic at all. It's just a little bit of European experience in dealing with Asia. It's entirely unstrategic, in fact. The whole Joschka Fischer used to complain that the European Union spent more time discussing Burma than it did discussing China, which was quite true, because there were deep, bitter arguments about Burma all the time, whereas with China, nobody really quite knew how to handle it. And we did indeed. What I, in a sense, represent the living proof that the EU is not a strategic actor. It doesn't think or act strategically. I would like it to myself. I would really like Europe to be a great power, because I think there are a lot of quite nasty great powers around, and the EU would be a rather less nasty great power than some, but that's probably just my own prejudice or imagination. I would like the EU to be a power, but it's got quite a long way to go before that happens. However, what I've therefore done is I've looked around for areas where I thought the EU could do something useful, and in particular, I've always tried to make the European Union, while I've been working there, and indeed before I was working there as well, I've always tried to get the European Union to be more political. I don't think there's much likelihood of the EU becoming a great military power, though, like Michael, I think there ought to be a military dimension to what the European Union does. But I think that we ought to be more politically conscious. That's why, for me, a little bit of the story I tell in Burma is of an attempt to get the EU to behave in a more political fashion in a moment in a country's life where politics is very important. But just to explain why I mean Burma was non-strategic, Burma is not strategically the heart of Asia. By the way, I'm saying Burma, I could equally well be saying Myanmar, because Dor Aung San Suu Kyi has now said formally that she doesn't care which people say. The European Union itself had some trouble making up its mind which to say, and therefore used to say Burma/Myanmar, or sometimes, when the pro-Myanmar faction got very strong, Myanmar/Burma. But the intervention was not of any calculated strategy at all. It was an emotional reaction to the events that happened in Burma at different stages from 1988 onwards. The sanctions we imposed were not intended to promote regime change. They were much too weak for that. This was not part of a great democracy-building project in the world, because we never really bothered that much about democracy in Indonesia or Thailand or Vietnam. There was no strategy behind this. It was a series of accidents. Personally, I was enormously surprised when the change took place in Burma. We certainly didn't plan it, but I was lucky enough to be involved, and I therefore tried to get the EU to be a little bit less stodgy and a little bit more involved in the political drama that was taking place. And having got the European Union to announce that its objectives were highly political, were peace and democracy, to get the European Union to put money into both of those things and to put quite a lot of effort into both of those things, though I'm not quite sure if I recount it in this essay, the development people got round to deciding to do these, but they didn't really take them quite seriously in the end. There's still work to do there. In practice, we didn't do such a bad job. But we didn't really do the job. The job was in the end done by the Burmese. The European contribution, I think, was useful, but was relatively marginal. As a matter of fact, I even got myself engaged with the military at one point. At a point when nobody was seeing the military, I went to see the Deputy Defense Minister, who was a Commodore. If I'd had more enthusiasm from Brussels, I'm sure we could have developed a military dimension to the relationship. We did develop a dimension in police reform, which was quite successful, and which is a good civilian thing to do. I could probably tell you a story about how this is an important strategic intervention in Asia. It could be. But that depends on having something more like a strategy for Asia in general. Actually, this is an important country. It's a very large country. It has a very long border with China. It's an important member in ASEAN. If it turns out to be, at the moment, the ASEAN countries are, as I understand from Burmese foreign ministry, are a little bit puzzled by what's going on and are saying to Burma, look, we've seen that you now seem to have complete freedom of the press, and you've just held some elections which were genuine and fair. Is this really going to go on like this? So maybe it will have an impact on ASEAN as well. But that was not the point. This was actually just an opportunity which we took, and I'm happy that we did. I say two more words about EU strategy generally. It's actually, it's in a way quite disappointing that the place where diplomacy was invented, a dozen countries in Europe had very strong diplomatic traditions, very strong diplomatic establishments. It's very strong that collectively, it's very sad that collectively this doesn't amount to anything. If you want to know, and it won't amount to anything just by creating something called global strategy either. If you want to know what it should do in order to amount to something as a political actor, then you can read another essay that I've written, and Julia can tell you where to find that. I'm not quite sure where that's going to appear. That appears somewhere or other under the auspices of Dahrendorf Forum as well. I can tell you more about Myanmar if you like, but it's a little bit a kind of specialist theme in Asia.
Good. Thank you very much, Robert. All right. Good. I think...